I'm very much indebted to Professor Shima for inviting me to come to Prague, not only to participate in this conference, but also to serve as a member of the faculty for a brief time. I have been visiting professor in the Faculty of Economics and Public Administration for the past 2 weeks, and that has given me the honor of attempting to teach a number of the students at the University of Economics, and I'm very happy for that opportunity. In addition, I've received great generosity and hospitality from the Liberal Institute here in Prague, and I've had the opportunity to go to that institute and to make two presentations regarding books of my own, but with respect to subjects in which there's great interest everywhere, including here in the Czech Republic. I'm especially grateful to Professor Shima and to his colleagues who took a great effort to translate some of my recent writing into the Czech language and to produce the book whose cover he showed on the screen a few minutes ago. I'm quite honored to have this appearance in Czech language, and if you read Czech more comfortably than you read English, then I hope you will take the opportunity to read this little book and perhaps to tell your friends or students about it, and perhaps we can spread the word. Finally, I'm honored to present in particular the Wieser Lecture. As Professor Shima mentioned, Wieser was the teacher of F.A. Hayek at the University of Vienna. Hayek, of course, lived a long time and influenced very many people. In a sense, he taught millions of people, directly or indirectly. But I was one of those privileged to know Hayek in person, to meet him some 30 years ago and to spend time with him. And I've been greatly influenced during my career by Hayek's work, and I continue to study them today. So Wieser begat Hayek, and Hayek, in a way, begat me as a scholar. I want to speak briefly to you in this lecture about a topic that I have been studying for many years. I first began to think seriously about it more than 30 years ago. In the beginning, I did not write about it, but I did spend a good deal of time arguing about it with my colleague, Douglas North, who was at that time one of the experts on the relationship of government to the American economy in U.S. economic history. I did not always agree with my colleague, and after a number of years, I finally decided that perhaps my views ought to be written down and expressed more fully, and so I set out to write a book which was not published until 1987 called Crisis and Leviathan. So in one way or another, I have been working on the subject of the growth of government for 30 years and writing about it for 25 years, and I'm well aware that some of you in the audience have heard me speak on this topic before, so I apologize in advance if I sing a song that you've heard me sing in the past. If you haven't heard this song, then that's good. It'll be new music to your ears. My work has dealt in many ways, not simply with the growth of government as a general phenomenon, especially in the United States and in the Western countries, but in particular with the role that crises, national emergencies, have played in the growth of government. When I began to read the literature about the growth of government, which was beginning to be of considerable interest in the field of economics and political science in the late 1970s and early 1980s, I found that very few economists had anything much to say about any special role that crisis might have played in that process of growth. There were some who spoke about it, but usually only in passing. There was a book by the British writers Peacock and Wiseman that dealt with it at some length, but only with regard to the history of the growth of the British state's fiscal activities. They were at pains to argue that there had existed a definite effect from the two world wars that placed the growth of the state in Great Britain on a higher trajectory than it would have had if the wars had never taken place. So Peacock and Wiseman were already talking about a theme that I would follow in many ways for the next several decades. Today I want to trace out the logic, as I understand it, of how crises play an especially prominent role in the process of the growth of government. These ideas were developed in the first place to help me understand better the course of economic history in the United States. Eventually, I came to see that they might also have substantial application in understanding the growth of government in other countries, certainly in the UK, but perhaps in other places as well. And I continue to believe that if they do not apply exactly in every historical case, they apply to many other countries, at least in part. I begin by assuming that the political rulers of society have considerable autonomy, which is to say, the rulers do not simply represent in some way the resultant of various forces brought to bear upon them by civil society. They have, in a sense, room for maneuver in order to seek ends that no one in civil society may have, to seek ends absolutely their own. I do not claim that rulers in any society are without constraints. Even in a dictatorship, the ruler is constrained in some way by forces that lie outside his control. In civil society, there may be active resistance, there may be latent resistance, there may be only potential resistance that might mount, but every ruler must bear in mind actual or potential resistance to the actions he chooses to take. So rulers, I assume, would like to expand their power, perhaps for noble reasons as they see them, perhaps for vicious reasons, as even they might admit were they compelled. But whatever the reasons, rulers can achieve their ends better if they have more power to determine what happens in the society they rule. So there is a constant pressure. Rulers seek to expand their powers, and in reaction to that, or working in opposition to it, various forces in civil society resist that expansion of governmental power and press against it. At any given moment, the boundary between those decisions about resource allocation and enjoyment made by the ruler and his apparatus of government and those decisions made by members of civil society, by what nowadays is usually called the private sector, the boundary between those two opposing forces will represent a placement of the size of government. Many measures of the size of government have been used in research. When I began my studies, it was common for the size of government to be measured by such variables as government spending relative to gross domestic product. Similar measures have been used. We might alternatively use a measure such as employment by the state as a proportion of all employment. These kinds of measures were appealing to mainstream economists and political scientists because they can be readily quantified, and therefore they lent themselves to use in econometric models. I believe in many ways it was unfortunate that the study of the growth of government began on this basis, because one consequence was that immediately many very real and important elements of government power were neglected, unmeasured. Sometimes analysts would recognize their existence but proceed simply by claiming that those parts of government size that were not measured by conventional measures were correlated closely with the parts that were measured. Unfortunately, they made no attempt to demonstrate the validity of that assumption, and only a little study is required to show that in many cases it is not correct. Very often, we may see no trace of the growth of government in a conventional measure, such as government spending relative to the gross domestic product, and yet government's power and its control over decision-making in society may grow enormously by virtue of legal changes, changes in regulations, changes in judicial rulings, or other means. Therefore, when I wrote my book, I decided to look not only at conventional measures of the growth of government, but to look at other evidence with regard to how government might have strengthened its powers over time. I believe that everyone should pay attention to these broader measures. If not, we risk making serious mistakes in our interpretations. Within my framework of understanding, then, the question for the rulers, the question for the government in power, is always the question how to move the boundary, how to move the dividing line between those decisions about resource allocation and enjoyment made by the government and those made by others. Move it in favor of the government's decision making. If we ask what conditions are required for the government to succeed in that effort, I believe we'll find that two conditions are fundamental. The first is that within society, a dominant ideology exists which leads people to look upon the government for their salvation. An ideology which causes people to demand, as it were, that in the face of some perceived problem, especially a serious problem affecting many people in society, government should do something. It should not stand by and simply declare that people should take care of the problem themselves. An ideology must exist that government do something. Now, one might think that's only natural for people to expect or demand, but in reality, it has been the case in some previous times and places that people did not, in general, have that ideology with regard to the role of government in society. If you were able to transport yourself by time machine to the United States in, let us say, the year 1850, you would find that the dominant ideology at that time was one that led people to think of government as properly confined to a very narrow role. And even very serious societal problems did not cause them to think that government should do anything. They looked to their own salvation. They expected that in adversity, people would seek and receive help from their friends, their relatives, their neighbors, from voluntary associations, from charities that existed or might be formed, from the churches, from large numbers of institutions actively operating in civil society. If you had suggested to them that government ought to get involved, they would have resisted the suggestion. They would have said, that would be a mistake. Why? They would have said, because government cannot be trusted to expand beyond its narrow, minimal functions of maintaining order and protecting private property. If it is expanded any further, then we risk even further expansion. And eventually we bear the risk that government will become tyrannical. The American people had mounted a revolution against what they believed to be the tyranny of the British state. And they, as the 19th century had worn on, they had developed even stronger views with regard to the importance of a free economy and the maintenance of limited government. The British, at about the same time, had a dominant ideology not very different. Laissez-faire was the name, first proposed by the French physiocrats of the late 18th century, but adopted with wide currency in the 19th century and used with either pride or with mockery to refer to the view that government should be kept limited, small, that people should have self-responsibility and not look to the state for their salvation. Of course, that ideological condition changed everywhere. Everywhere that it had existed in the 19th century, it began to grow weaker toward the end of the 19th century. And by the early 20th century in the United States, the balance was beginning to tip in favor of a view that sounds much more modern, a view that government ought to be active, that government has the potential to solve many social problems, and that it is entirely right and proper that people look to the government to solve problems, small as well as big. So with the development of socialism and other collectivist views, throughout the Western world, people began to think about government in a different way. The second condition that makes the expansion of government power successful, especially in a crisis, is the sudden occurrence of a threat. Anything that makes people suddenly afraid, fearful of their well-being, either their lives, perhaps their economic well-being, perhaps some other aspect of their security. Crisis. an appropriate ideological precondition plus a crisis gives rise almost automatically to the growth of government, because those conditions lead to an increased deference to government action, giving the government more autonomy and more discretion, decreased government resistance in civil society. Forces that might have resisted the growth of government in normal times may decide that in crisis, government expansion is desirable. When events happen in this way, when a crisis occurs, government expands, there are definite consequences. These events are never transitory. They're never events that come and go, and then afterward leave everything in society just as it was before the crisis. They always leave residues behind for several reasons. First is that during the crisis, when government expands, it often creates new institutions to deal with the perceived crisis, perhaps new agencies, new bureaus, new laws, new judicial rulings. And with the passing of the crisis, these institutions prove to have permanent staying power, the ability to remain alive during normal times, even though they were created expressly for the purpose of dealing with an emergency. They always have supporters, often those who've operated them during the crisis. And those supporters have a built-in advantage because they know more about these institutions than anyone else. So they can always defend them very, very astutely, whereas the opponents may not be so well placed to argue against them. Often, the supporters of crisis-created institutions will see a potential for turning those institutions to new uses. They may admit that the emergency has passed and yet argue that these same institutions, though created to deal with the crisis, can be used very usefully in normal times. Everyone understands that a bureau is easier to create than to destroy. In my country, it's fair to say that a government agency is almost impossible to destroy under modern conditions. A few have been abolished, but very few. The second thing that happens after the crisis has passed is that we find there have been ideological changes. Ideologies do not simply spring from people's study of great books. Especially for ordinary people, ideological change springs in considerable part from people's way of understanding and reacting to their own experience. No experience makes a greater impact on them than the experience of national emergency, of great wars, for example, of great business depressions. These things affect almost everyone in a substantial way. They cannot be ignored. So they come to have an effect on everyone's thinking. And often, the kind of change that crisis leaves in its wake is the view that government really ought to play a bigger role than it played before the crisis. People will be told, of course, by the government managers of crisis institutions that they have done a splendid job in dealing with crisis, that the institutions they created have operated with great success, even though historians may later tell us their efforts were complete failures. They have a personal interest in justifying or even glorifying what they've done. And often they have a personal interest in perpetuating it as well. Of course, the government will use propaganda before, during, and after any crisis to justify an expanded role for itself. Here in Prague, I don't need to give you any lessons about propaganda. We all understand that very often propaganda misses its target, that after a while people may dismiss it, disregard it, and think of it as nothing more than noise. And yet, there must be a purpose served by propaganda, because every modern government makes great efforts to propagandize its own citizens. I'm confident that it has some effect. As a result of these consequences of crisis, each crisis episode under modern ideological conditions tends to take a characteristic form, and I call the taking of this form a ratchet effect. The diagram shows a stylized representation of how a crisis episode operates. I have pretended in measuring my variable that I am God, and that therefore I can measure a perfect index of the size of government. I can measure all the ways in which government exerts power or control over decision-making in society, and that's measured on the vertical axis. Time is measured on the horizontal axis. What I've shown is that before the crisis, government is already growing, as it was tending to grow from the late 19th century onward in most of the Western countries. Not rapidly, slowly, but growing little by little. With the onset of crisis, we have a sudden increase in the size of government. Government begins to do things it had not done before. It begins to exercise new functions, to impose new controls. So government becomes suddenly quite a lot bigger. And perhaps for a time, between the points I've labeled C and D, it operates at a high, expanded level. Every crisis ends, and when it ends, the justifications disappear for the crisis measures that government has taken. And normally, government does, in fact, retrench after the crisis. It does abandon some of the crisis measures. It does close some of the emergency bureaus. It may allow some of its emergency laws to lapse, or it may actually repeal some of them. After all, there are always insistent demands from civil society that we get back to normal life. When people can no longer see a clear reason for greatly expanded government power, there will be some demand for its retrenchment. And so there will be some reduction in its power. But as the diagram shows, that reduction will not bring society back to the status quo antebellum. It will not bring us back to the point where the process began before the crisis. Indeed, as I've shown it, it will not even bring us back to the trend line of government growth that existed before the crisis. So it raises the level of the size of government, by which here I mean size, scope, power, all rolled into a single measure. It raises it to a higher level, even if it grows at the same rate as it grew before, and makes it not bigger for only a while, but bigger permanently. Now, this is a representation of just one episode, but what we can easily imagine is that as we continue in time, another crisis does come. When I wrote my first book in 1987 on this topic, it was not well received by many reviewers. At the time, many people argued that big government was a problem of the past, that the Reagan Revolution, as some people called it, had tamed Leviathan, that we did not need to worry any longer about the growth of government, that we might even look forward to a shrinking of the size of government before long. My response was then, and remained from that time on, nonsense. It will take only the next big emergency to change all of these constraints you believe are now operating in 1987. And such a crisis will certainly occur. I did not make a prophecy of what kind of crisis that would be, although I mentioned certain possibilities, including economic collapse, war, and rampant terrorism. Not much time had to pass before, in the year 2001, in the United States, another perceived crisis did strike with suddenness, and the effect was identical in its basic structure. Sudden, heightened fear, insecurity, a turning to the government, even by people who had expressed the greatest distrust of the government, the greatest desire to shrink it. Many then turned to the government, looking to it to protect them from what they believed might be a terrible menace awaiting them should the terrorists continue to carry out attacks such as that of September 11th, 2001. The government was entirely happy to respond to those demands. It took many actions immediately. It passed new laws, including a law known as the USA Patriot Act, providing for much greater government surveillance, not just of potential terrorists, but of all people. It provided for the confiscation of private assets, not simply of people who might be engaged in supporting terrorism, but of anyone suspected of any federal crime. In a variety of ways, these laws enacted ostensibly to protect against terrorism were immediately turned to a variety of other purposes. Anyone with historical perspective might have expected precisely that course of events. And indeed, when I spoke to journalists within 2 weeks after those attacks of 9/11, I predicted that these consequences would follow. I'm sorry to say my predictions were correct, and they've only become more correct in the years since then. This is a graph showing the federal government spending relative to gross national product in the United States from the year 1790 all the way to 1990. So we have a very long view here. What we can see is that in the 19th century, the federal government never spent very much money as a proportion of gross domestic product. There are two places that stand out in the 19th century. Both have to do with wars. The first little bulge above the trend line occurred during America's second war with England. And the big spike in the middle of the century, of course, occurred during the war between the states in the 1860s. But other than that, the federal government was held well in check for more than a century. And even after the Civil War, though there were some consequences of the kind I've described, in general, the federal government returned to the same kinds of activities that it had traditionally undertaken, which were quite limited. So that even in the early 20th century, the federal government was a relatively small factor in American life. The state governments and local governments played larger roles, but even when all governments together are combined, their expenditures relative to gross national product were only about 7 or 8% on the eve of World War I. However, as I've said, during the early 20th century, a change in ideology had taken place, especially among opinion leaders in the United States. We call it progressivism. And that change, something like what Europeans call social democracy, that change had a powerful effect in altering the conditions in which any future crisis would operate. This is a depiction of Swedish central government spending as a percentage of gross national product. Now, if you have held in your memory the preceding display, you'll immediately see some substantial similarities between what happened in the United States historically and what happened in Sweden. And that's really remarkable, I believe, because these two societies differ in so many ways. Especially, they differ in that Sweden was not a belligerent in either of the world wars. And yet, you see from this chart, the same kinds of crisis effects and perhaps ratchets that are apparent in the American experience of the 20th century. Perhaps you know that even though Sweden was not a belligerent in World War I or World War II, it prepared to be a belligerent. And it was that preparation that explains the spikes in central government spending we see in this chart. Just as in the United States, during the Cold War, actual fighting explains relatively little of the amounts the government spent for defense. Preparation for war accounts for the great bulk of that spending. So what we see in historical experience, these two graphs being examples, we could look at many different measures. None of them is ideal, such as my God's eye view in the schema, but all of these measures tend to show evidence of the operation of a crisis ratchet effect. If what I've said is approximately correct, then there are some implications. Two in particular I'll mention. The first implication is that government leaders will make efforts to exploit exogenous crises, by which I mean crises that come upon a society from the outside, crises that were not deliberately brought about by anyone as such. Crises such as the wars, the world wars that came to have such a great effect on the United States, coming from the outside. Government leaders will exploit exogenous crises to serve their own interests. They will readily grasp new power, which they will say are necessary to give people protection from heightened threats. And, in addition, government leaders will be strongly tempted, especially when no exogenous crisis arises, to create a crisis or the appearance of one. There has been in history more than one burning of the Reichstag. That's become a kind of metaphor for the crisis that was false. The crisis perhaps engineered by the very leaders who used it to justify their seizure of new power. You need not be a conspiracy theorist. Historians have documented very well many of the instances in which government either creates a crisis or propagates the fear that a crisis exists in order to justify some new power. I actually maintain that this process has become almost chronic in modern life. In my country, any given day brings upon the television screen the presentation of what I call the danger du jour, the new threat, the one people hadn't been aware of before, something poison in the water, something toxic in the food, some grave environmental risk, some terrorist group we had known nothing about before. Each day, a new threat, a new danger, and always the implied or explicit implication that government must do something to protect us from this new danger du jour. Modern people are bombarded with messages designed to make them afraid. And not surprisingly, many are indeed afraid. As long ago as the 1940s, Bertrand de Jouvenel wrote that the characteristic feature of modern minds is apprehension, is fear, which seems anomalous in so many ways because modern people are, in fact, so much more secure than their ancestors ever dreamed of being. We don't worry about starvation. We don't worry about the disastrous effects of a bad crop year. We don't worry about the many things that our ancestors had legitimate reason to fear. And yet, we've all become irrationally fearful. The second implication is that government will grow relentlessly. It will exploit exogenous crises, or it will create endogenous crises, and it will use them to expand its powers and extend its sway over civil society. And it will continue to do so until it manifestly wrecks the economy or the society. We've seen experiences of that. We know that the Soviet Union was a society where the rulers expanded their power until they manifestly wrecked the economy, and it could no longer be denied. Not even they could deny it. We've seen in more civilized places, such as Sweden, the welfare state expanded to such great limits that eventually even the rulers became aware that they were wrecking the Swedish economy. Their high taxes, their extreme welfare state benefits were making it impossible for economic growth to continue. And so even they, the Swedes, began to back away from those limits they had reached. But until such limits are reached, all modern governments will continue to grow. Some 200 years ago, Thomas Jefferson said that the natural tendency is for government to gain ground and liberty to yield. If that was true in Jefferson's day, how much truer it is today. So let me conclude briefly by asking, is a reversal possible? Of course. In matters of human society, we face very few impossibilities. We're the makers of our own history. But in order for a reversal of this process to occur, two things must be done. Someone must deconstruct collectivist ideology, by which I mean both deconstruct it in the sense of making people aware of its implications, taking it apart as literary analysts take apart a text. But they must also deconstruct it in the sense that they must tear it down. They must replace it by an ideology more fit for a free society. Secondly, someone must deconstruct this atmosphere of fear and insecurity that now envelops Western people. Someone must somehow show them that these fears and insecurities are in large part unfounded, that they have less to fear than they think from the sources they've been brought to fear, whereas they have more to fear from the governments they believe will save them. Modern people in the West, having given up their traditional worship of the Christian God, have transferred their worship effectively to the state. Like Winston Smith in George Orwell's novel 1984, they have come to love Big Brother. The state is effectively their God. But the state, at bottom, is a false god, a gigantic hoax, a trick played by the palace priests of the rulers. People regard it all too often as a god of love, like the Christian God in the Bible's New Testament, for which they substituted it. But in biblical terms, it is actually a god of wrath, more akin to the Christian God of the Bible's Old Testament. It imposes harsh demands on them for sacrifices of all kinds, and it stands ready to wreak violent punishment on the people who resist its demands. To escape from the sway of this false religion of the state, people must come to understand that despite its constant pressures, its constant promises to save people from all dangers and to solve all their problems, big and small, the government will not, indeed, it cannot, save them. To gain genuine solutions to their problems, people must learn to take responsibility for themselves, making voluntary arrangements and transactions and creating voluntary organizations for the attainment of their purposes. A society of free and responsible individuals is the only one that holds out any real hope for a better world in the long run. Thank you very much.